This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. I am Tan Chung Han, and with me is Melissa Idris.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 29th, and you are tuned into BFM 89.9. This is the morning run, final business day of the third quarter of 2017. So come Monday, we're into the home stretch there, Melissa.
Oh my God. Has it been three quarters already? Where was I?
I know, right?
I feel like I've been sleeping and woke up in the fourth quarter.
Well, so that's the thing. We got to make the last 3 months count. Any year-end goals to be met still?
Well, okay. So usually at the end of the year is when you kind of do that mad rush to meet whatever New Year's resolutions that you abandoned in February.
January for some.
I think that I failed the most at saving money, because that was my biggest goal this year, was to save money. But I did achieve one goal, Han. At the start of the year, I said I promised myself that I was going to learn how to ride a bike this year.
Bicycle?
Yeah. Okay, I know.
Where have you been for the last 30 years?
Jaws on the floor.
This is an essential life skill.
I know. Okay. And I've just learned that it is an essential life skill.
Oh, okay, well, better late than never then.
Exactly.
All right, moving on to some headlines there. You've got the leader of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He's back after an 11-month silence. He produced a pretty long audio message, apparently a 46-minute one.
Wait, what do you mean he's back? I thought the Russians killed him.
Ah, there we go. So apparently back in May 28th, there was reportedly an airstrike by the Russians, and they claimed that they almost certainly killed Baghdadi. Turns out, not so. I mean, they are still trying to verify this audio tape, but he did make some seemingly recent references to the threats of North Korea, and of course, you know, once again, amplifying the jihadi message there. So, doubts now being raised whether or not he's actually alive.
Yeah, right. Whether he was killed. Mm.
So you've got that. Also then, speaking about North Korea, you've got the global pushback against North Korea. That's certainly wrapping up. Now, this time, it's coming from China. So you've got the Chinese government there telling North Korean companies operating in its territory, in Chinese territory, to close down. Obviously, this follows that sixth and most powerful nuclear test that the North Koreans just carried out recently.
Yeah, I think that if any country in the world were to impose sanctions on North Korea that would be effective, it would be China. So to see China, which is essentially North Korea's only ally at this point in time, putting in sanctions, I think that speaks volumes.
Well, I mean, even with all the other UN sanctions, right, and with the ramping up pressure from the US, yet they have still gone about with a missile test. So I think, you know, these coming days, I believe they've got a deadline of 120 days. That's a deadline set by China's Commerce Ministry to see, you know, whether there's a significant altering in the behavior of Rocket Man and Co.
Rocket Man will be Rocket Man, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the saying, guys.
Moving over to the stateside, at least for a U.S. territory, the rescue efforts for Puerto Rico, that's continuing. And in fact, now you've got the White House administration lifting the shipping ban, kind of like a cabotage policy for the storm-hit island. Previously, aid from U.S. ships only were allowed. Now, at least, any kind of sea traffic would only be limited to U.S. ships. Now, apparently, that shipping ban has been lifted. Also in the news, Seinfeld star Julia Louis-Dreyfus, she has reportedly has breast cancer. So
yeah, I saw that overnight on Twitter, people responding to this. She just won like an Emmy, I think, for Veep, for her role in Veep.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, I mean, and celebrating that was one of her many Emmys. And then to be, I guess, had this diagnosis. But to be able to share it with the public, I thought was really strong and brave. Right.
And she's been a star of Veep for the last 5 years, but arguably more famous for her stint in, starring role in Seinfeld back in the 90s. All right, we've got to take a quick break. Coming up, we'll discuss the legacy of Hugh Hefner, the late Hugh Hefner. This is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Harvest Moon by Neil Young. Quite the tune to whisk us away into the fourth quarter of 2017.
But I love it. What a wonderful way to kind of start the day, right? Just kind of slowly ease into the morning on a Friday morning. Nice, lovely.
Yeah, certainly. Now, what it is, well, that song has a very contrasting tone to what we're about to discuss here. So, big news yesterday, Hugh Hefner passed away at the age of 91. And obviously, discussion has been rife about the legacy of the Playboy founder. Some initial thoughts from you, Melissa.
Well, okay, so it was kind of big news. So we saw the breaking news happen yesterday. I think it's just slightly less than 24 hours that that the news was confirmed. And there's been an outpouring of reaction to that news. Not all of them glowing tributes. I have seen some really glowing tributes about the Hef, as he's better known, but also some criticism of those glowing tributes.
Right. Yeah. So let's start with something, at least viewed in a positive light. This one coming from his son, Cooper Hefner, saying that his father was a living, quote, exceptional and impactful life as a media and cultural pioneer and a leading voice behind some of the most significant social and cultural movements of our time. He goes on to talk about how the late Hugh Hefner advocated free speech, civil rights, and sexual freedom. Now, I wonder, you know, obviously, the Hef was a controversial and polarizing figure. I wonder if these comments are, you know, perhaps casting or viewing it through some rose-tinted lenses. Perhaps.
Right, so because when the magazine was first published, I mean, there were a lot of people that were very dead set against this Playboy lifestyle and what it represented. Essentially, Hugh Hefner gave rise to porn as an industry. So if you look back at his cultural contributions or his role in shaping cultural history, he did play a big role, but whether that role was a positive one and left a positive impact is to be debated.
Well, some have said that the side effects of this flamboyant lifestyle, you know, of glorifying sex, wealth and success was perhaps the liberalization of women's rights, you know, especially in America. So do you contend that that is a valid argument, or would you say otherwise?
Meaning, did he serve the fight for feminism, for the feminist movement?
Yeah, I mean, essentially. Okay. I mean, while it was not, you know, obviously the intended audience for his Playboy franchise was for the males in their 20s and 30s, right? But, you know, he's saying as a byproduct of that enterprise, or so he claims, it's that, you know, women's rights are then, or the liberalization of women's rights are then being brought out into the mainstream and then being discussed.
I understand. Those are his, the people who are paying tribute to him say that he was a big role to play in early women's rights, and he championed pro-choice, he championed sexual liberation and birth control. But really, at the end of the day, I wonder whether he did those things because it was in the interest of Playboy to do so. Mm. So, I mean, that was also the argument that his championing of those causes were, in fact, you know, for his own benefit.
Right, because obviously that we are, you know, now that this discussion has evolved tremendously over the last few decades, you know, you do not need to go through these vices to promote women's rights. Obviously, there's a more direct approach now. And, you know, so it almost seems like this entire Playboy culture is definitely dated.
Well, I've read really scathing reviews of these glowing tributes, Han, online from feminists who say, you know, we won't shed a tear because Hugh Hefner essentially gave rise to the objectification of women as sexual objects, that he made women seem that they were collectible sexual trophies. So all in all, they said, you know, it's not to speak ill of the dead, but it's good to see the Playboy lifestyle be done away with.
Yeah, well, not quite entirely done away with, because Playboy Enterprises still carries on, and you have seen again this shift in the offerings under the Playboy umbrella. They have now moved into the online space. Recently, they went into various branding and merchandising as well. You know, so it's not just your good old print magazine, right? But nevertheless, this conversation certainly rages on. And now, to be very clear, I'm not necessarily condoning what they have was promoting, but, you know, it's certainly, given the discussion that has been rife over the last 24 hours or so, you know, I think it's something that we have to also analyze, because certainly here in Malaysia, given that we are broadly speaking, a more traditional and conservative society. Perhaps our affinity for, you know, somebody like Hef or the values that he may espouse, you know, it's not something that really hits home for us, right?
Well, I do have to say, one of the things that I discovered reading the discussions about Hef's contributions to the world was this. I didn't know, but they have appointed his daughter, Christy Hefner, to become CEO and chairman of Playboy Enterprises in 1975. And she served in that role until 2009, making her the longest serving female chairman and CEO of a public company in US history, which says a lot for having a woman lead this, the Playboy company, essentially, given the fact that so few women are represented on the boards of public listed companies in the US.
So perhaps, you know, it pokes at this notion of, you know, say the Playboy enterprise being something that discriminates or downplays the value or the role of women, you know, when obviously you've got a woman who is
leading the company. Exactly.
At the same time, you know, those who support him also talk about his contributions to the civil rights movement at a time when comedy clubs were segregated. He invited black comics to his his comic clubs in Miami and New Orleans. So you've got that as well. Certainly this discussion continues, and I think it's something that we as Malaysians we really have to start talking about this as well, right, as we move along this feminist agenda. Alright, it's coming up, it's just past 6:16 right now, and we'll be back after these messages right here on BFM 89.9. Lover of Mine by Beach House right here on BFM 89.9. You are tuned into the Morning Run. I am Tan Chung Han, and with me in the studio is
Melissa Idris.
Good morning, Melissa.
Hello. All right.
So, Melissa, there was a study done by Deloitte recently about the female participation in boardrooms, and it turns out Asia is far behind Europe. So, well, no surprise there, really, right? So, Asia is almost the worst in the world, behind Latin America. Average of 7.8% of female directors versus Europe's 22.6%.
Sorry, right? Could you repeat that? Asia has how many percent?
7.8%. So, less than 8%.
Oh, compared to 22% in the Western world.
Almost 23% for Europe. Yeah. So, you know, obviously, despite, you know, just before the song, we were talking about the rising feminist agenda across the world, but has it translated into the corporate world, at least at the board level? Obviously not, based on Deloitte's studies. So the question here is, where is that will going to come from, right? Does gender diversity have to be willed into existence by legislators, by the government?
Well, yeah, that's really kind of the age-old question, whether quotas are essentially the best way of getting more women on boards and keeping them there, whether legislative solutions are the best way. I have to say, Han, I am actually a fan of quotas, and this is one of the very few instances where I do believe quotas may work in a top-down approach. So a couple of years ago, I spoke to the 30% Club, which is a body, this is based in the UK, looking at trying to get more women on boards of companies, especially public listed companies. And they say, well, they were against quotas because they say the best way to do that is to have an organic approach and to really change the minds of men. So to get men to change their minds about bringing on more women on boards, and that's the best and most sustainable way to keep women on the boards. However, I do disagree, because I think we've had enough data now to show that that's simply not working, that waiting for this kind of organic approach is not working, that perhaps we need more legislative solutions.
Right, at least when it comes to societies that may have more patriarchal influences, right? Certainly in Asia, that seems to be the stereotype. And you've got this article from Bloomberg here saying that men often choose their best friends, not the best people.
Is it like a boys' club?
Right, pretty much. Yeah. So suggesting that meritocracy, you know, really has, or there's a lag when it comes to adopting this meritocratic mindset.
Well, you know, Asia often lags behind the West when it comes to adopting certain approaches. I mean, if you look at the human rights approach, it takes a while for things to kind of trickle down to Asia, looking at kind of same-sex marriage acceptance. It takes a long time for things to
even
move.
Even feminism.
It takes a long time to move into Asia. But do you think this is just a time lag, you reckon?
Well,
simply because of our culture is more patriarchal?
Well, I would like to think so. But then again, you know, given that some of these high-profile global companies actually are being accused of having these all-male boards. Now, I'm looking at this list here. You got SoftBank Group, you've got Tencent Holdings, Baidu, Samsung, right? All these companies,
big companies,
have all-male boards. Only in Alibaba, they have got one woman on the board.
Oh,
right?
Man.
So it just so shows you this yawning gap between where we are and, you know, where the developed world is. You know, now Latin America, fine, you know, they're behind us, but still that's you know, using a whole different yardstick. So again, you know, whether or not organic growth is something that we can be relied on in order to make sure there is more gender equality.
Sure. And I have heard of the argument that by having these quotas put in place, it could mean you have kind of proxy women put on board, sisters and wives and friends of that, you know, just to fill in the quotas. And I have heard that allegation as well.
All right, hopefully these companies can find their killer queen, which is the title of this next song by none other than Queen, right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I am Tan Chung Han, and with me is
Melissa Idris.
And that was Jockey Full of Bourbon by Tom Waits. Jockey Full of Bourbon, of course, not describing the state of the Morning Run crew right now. At least not yet. I don't know.
Well, Han, you know, you're heading into the weekend.
Yeah,
sure, so, you've got plans.
Yeah, maybe jockey soon to be full of bourbon. I don't know. So it's right now 6:39 on Friday, September 29th, the final business day of the third quarter of 2017. So we've got a big study here that argues that political campaigns, they do not change minds, which is quite the revelation, I would think, given the millions, if not billions, that is spent on election campaigns, all, you know, in any jurisdiction there. It appears that the effect is close to zero. That's what these researchers contend. So, you know, really, is this a revelation to you here, Melissa?
Well, I have to say, I was quite fascinated with this recent research because it really does argue, and it was very US-centric, right? So they looked at the recent US elections and they compared the different campaign strategies, whether be it early in the campaign period or later in the campaign period. And essentially what they found, and they had a very kind of scientific approach to this, what they found was that political campaigns tend to not change voters' political allegiances. The effect was minimal, almost zero, as you mentioned. Mm. And the reason for this, they could only surmise, was that Americans particularly are facing hardening partisanship. So once you've decided who you vote for, there really is no wiggle room in changing that mind. But what was particularly fascinating with this research was what campaigns could change was trying to encourage voters to go out and vote. So if you were, say, a Clinton supporter, those political campaigns could either encourage you to go out and vote and exercise your right to vote, or vice versa, it could actually make you say, oh, I'm not going to bother, maybe she's going to win, I'm just going to sit at home.
Yeah, so it can influence actions but not mindsets per se, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which then begs the question then, so how do we even develop these you know, political inclinations to begin with, right? Because if they're saying that these visits or door-to-door visits or that TV ad or that phone call, which political campaigns spend a lot of money on,
sure,
if those don't work, then how do we even form those you know, political biases? Is it due to society, sociological factors? You know, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that really goes down to the basis of how we receive and process information, right? But essentially, it's how we create our social reality, and that often comes from the people we associate ourselves most closely with, perhaps our parents and our family members. We learn from what they like and what they don't like about political ideology, and also our friends. And this comes down to confirmation bias. Mm. The reason why political campaigns don't change our minds is because we tend to surround ourselves with information that confirms what we believe to be true about our worldview. And because of this confirmation bias and selective exposure, we tend to reject any information that challenges it, because it causes us this cognitive dissonance that causes us this pain in our brains that, right. Oh no, my worldview is wrong, so we avoid it.
Right, and you raised it, or you used a really good phrase there, that pain in the brain, because I saw this video online recently about how every time we are confronted with new facts that challenge our existing ideas, it triggers the same part of our brain that are also, processes pain, essentially. So that's why it's very uncomfortable when we are confronted with, you know, facts or data that may go against our bias, right? But I think there's also an element of a tribal instinct here, because, you know, in the interest of self-preservation, you don't want to be the sore thumb, right? You don't want to be the goon sticking out from the crowd, right?
Sure.
You want to...
It's kind of herd mentality, right?
Herd mentality, right? So I think that has a big part to play in terms of, you know, us developing our identities and also certainly our political ideas.
And I think technology has just amplified that, because now in this day and age, we can seek out and discuss the kind of news that pleases us with the kind of people who share our scientific theories. And there's no need for us to break out of that. But coming back to that research, Han, what I did think was interesting was they found that smear campaigns were particularly effective, because coming back to this kind of cognitive dissonance, or, you know, the pain about confronting something that's not true. So, for instance, if there was a smear campaign on a political opponent, so a negative ad, a political ad saying that, oh, this person does not do as he promises, the fact checking of that that political ad doesn't resonate in the minds of the viewer, because they've already decided. So it's easier to change someone's mind to the negative than it is to change someone's mind to the positive. I just don't register the fact checking.
But isn't that just so troubling then?
It is.
Because here we are trying to build a positive world and saying, you know, enough with the mud smearing, you know, let's try to do a positive campaign, and obviously that does not work. And we have got the data and the research to prove that now. So what does that say about the state of society? What does that say about the state of the electorate, especially as we, you know, were in the lead up to GE14, right?
It means now we are more divided than ever. And I have to say, a divided nation is an easily conquered nation.
Okay.
On that note, on a Friday morning.
Yeah. What happened to just holding hands and singing Kumbaya?
Kumbaya,
does
right?
that not work anymore?
I don't know.
I guess not.
Some plans for the weekend then.
All right, it's coming up to 6:45 a.m. This is the Morning Run on BFM 89.9. Love and Spoonful with Do You Believe in Magic, right here on BFM 89.9's Morning Run. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me is
Melissa Idris.
All right, so you've got the Sultan Idris Education University Vice Chancellor, Professor Muhammad Shatta Sabran, who has slammed student activists who spend their time protesting but neglected their studies. He says that the role of students is to focus on getting good grades. He says, and I quote, "I am not saying you cannot change the world. I am just saying that you cannot do it now when you are in university."
Yeah, so this was really interesting. His words were very divisive. What he said, just to continue that, this was a forum I think they had with between faculty and staff. And he also added to say, well, you know, if you get enough, high enough CGPA, then you'll graduate. And then one day you'll find a post with enough power to change the world, but not while you're still studying. Because he says, well, there's an increasing number of students who did poorly in university, but because or despite of, I'm not sure, but were active in protesting, right? So he made that correlation. And I'm curious to know whether this went down well with people. Looking at the comments online, it did not.
All right, so for more thoughts on this, we spoke to Syed Sadiq. He's the co-founder and youth wing chief of Pribumi Bersatu. We asked him his thoughts on this issue. How does real-world engagement while studying influence how invested youth become in activism after they graduate?
If I had not engaged in debating and youth activism, I'm very sure I wouldn't be where I'm at today. The reason being, as I traveled the world, as I taught debating and public speaking and youth activism in countries like Indonesia, Philippines, Qatar, China, India, the experiences which I gained made me a better person. And it opened my eyes to real-world issues and made me a concerned citizen of the global community, because I knew that my problem is not the be-all and end-all. That there's a global community around me which also needs assistance, and their issues should also be taken into the limelight. So for myself, because I debated a lot on public issues, which then got me into public policy, which then got me into politics, because the experiences which I received, the interactions which I got from the average Malaysian who I interviewed, who I taught from all parts of Malaysia, then gave me the platform, or better, it actually empowered me or gave me the hope to help them as well. You know, because if I only cared and lived in my own bubble, then my ability to continue the path of activism post-university will be minimal, because I do not see their concerns as my concerns as well. That will be more selfish than I would be selfless.
That was Syed Saddiq, the co-founder of Parti Pribumi Bersatu, perhaps talking about his real-world education. So going back to the Vice-Chancellor's comments there, I wonder if that's a fair way to frame the discussion, whereby it's an opportunity cost. You either focus on your studies or you know, go out there and be an activist.
I also have to point out that University Pendidikan Sultan Idris probably has been burned once before. This is the university that was that saw the student activist Adam Adli. If you remember, he was he was under some heat because of his comments that he made about May 13th. So maybe Oopsie or University Pendidikan Sultan Idris has been burned in this way, so they're making some comments. But you know, some of the comments that they made, I disagree with completely. And I think that in a sense it is not a zero sum game. It's not a trade off where if you are active in politics, you cannot then focus on your studies. Having said that, I came from a local university and I saw the internal workings of student politics. It does take up a lot of time. It does, it does suck up a lot of your time, time that could be used for other things as well.
Yeah, no, certainly. And drawing from my experiences in the States, you know, with when it came to, say, the college Republicans or college Democrats, they were certainly very active. And I did produce some political talk shows for my college radio station.
But, oh, nice. Yeah, so you were a radio DJ back in college.
Well, no, behind the scenes, behind the scenes. You know, but I did see the tremendous amount of effort that they put in. And sometimes I was quite envious because they had these connections to these political entities, not just at the city council level, but also at the state level. So, you know, and I think it has, basically been to their benefit. Mm. It certainly enriches their college experience over there.
I have to say, we also need to make the distinction between political activism and just activism, right? Social activism or civil activism. You don't have to be part of a political movement or to champion a political cause. Champion a cause, champion something, to repeat Syed Saddiq, so that you realize the world is so much bigger than yourself, right?
Right, but I think, so if we were to use that all-encompassing definition of activism, so essentially, perhaps, and I'm trying to give the VC the benefit of the doubt here, perhaps what he's suggesting is focus on your one job as a student, being your studies, right? Because after you graduate, there'll be ample opportunity to actually get involved, or get more involved at least, when it comes to activism, right? So, I mean, perhaps there is a case to be made about focusing on your good grades, and hopefully those good grades, you know, given the kind of society and the reward system that we have in society, you know, maybe he has a point. You know, focus on your good grades, get a more influential position, and then you can really then influence real change, perhaps.
Well, I completely disagree with him. But I'm not saying let your study slide, but practice activism. It comes from a good place. Practice championing a cause, and I don't think your studies should suffer for it.
Well, I guess anything beats apathy then. It's coming up to 6:55 on this Friday morning, September 29th. You're tuning into the Morning Run right here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, it's 7:06 on Friday, September 29th. I'm Tan Chung Han, and with me in the studio doing a little jig now is
Melissa Idris. Why? Because it's Friday.
Yeah, got to be descriptive here. Now, I wish our listeners could see you doing that dance right now.
No, the only reason I'm doing it because it's on radio.
There we go. All right, we've got a pretty jam-packed hour for you. After 7:15, we'll be looking at the front pages of the local newspapers. Plenty of real estate dedicated to the Tafiz school fire that happened in Keramat, KL. You've got suspects that have been charged now, so we'll give you the details at about 7:15. Then after the 7:30 a.m. bulletin, we'll be speaking to Tim Mulholland, president of TJM Limited in Chicago. We'll take a look at the global markets there and what's driving those fund flows. After that, we'll be taking a look at the business space, looking ahead to Malaysia's LEAP market, which will kick off next week. So plenty in store for you between now and 8 a.m. But now let's go back to this story that has dominated headlines quite a bit these past few days. The story of the laundromat in Johor that aimed to serve Muslim customers only. So obviously that's been a hot topic of debate. Subsequent to the Tempest calls being made to revive the National Harmony and Reconciliation Bill, among others, CIMB Chairman Dato' Sri Nazir Razak and ASLI Centre Chairman Tan Sri Ramon Navaratnam. It was among the bills previously proposed in the National Unity Blueprint by the National Unity Consultative Council, NUCC.
Well, Han, the other two bills that were proposed as well, along with the National Harmony and Reconciliation Bill, was also the National Harmony and Reconciliation Commission Bill, as well as a Racial and Religious Hate Crimes Bill, which, I don't know, I mean, that seems like good things to put forth in Malaysia today.
All right, so first things first, we spoke to Lim Chee Wee, who was formerly the deputy chair of the Working Committee on Law and Policy of the NUCC. And, he shares his thoughts and just kind of refreshes our memory on what this is all about.
The NUCC was established by the Prime Minister a few years ago to assist the Prime Minister with suggestions on how to improve national unity and religious harmony. And the NUCC then came up with a report back in 2015. And since then, there's been no news as to the status of the government's position on that report.
We also asked Lim Chee Wee what would have happened if the bill had been enacted in this particular case of the laundromat.
All right. The NUCC recommended the enactment of three pieces of legislation, the first of which is the Racial and Religious Hate Crimes Bill. That was meant to repeal the Sedition Act, which was originally promised by the Prime Minister. And what that Racial and Religious Hate Crimes Bill would do is to punish racial and religious hatred whilst protecting the right to freedom of speech and expression. And it's different from the Sedition Act in that it requires intention and element of physical harm. It is the second bill, known as the National Harmony and Reconciliation Bill, which would have an impact on the current Muslims-only laundromat. What that second bill does is to give meaning and effect to Article 8 of our federal constitution in promoting and protecting equality. So the bill would actually prohibit unfair discrimination on the grounds of religion, belief, race, descent, place of birth, gender, or disability. So if that bill had been law, then any Muslims only, Christians only, Buddhists only, Hindu only outlet would be prohibited.
Again, that was Lim Chee Wee, a former deputy chair of the Working Committee on Law and Policy of the NUCC. So, Mel, looks like we've got a theme so far on the morning run this morning, you know, whereby whether or not, or how effective would legislation or these committees or these, you know, chairs be when it comes to altering human behavior, especially in light with of what we learned with that laundromat down there in Johor.
Well, I feel like I wish we had this bill now, and I'm really sad to know that since this report came out 2015, there's been no news of the status of these bills, of the government's position on the status of these bills, right? Because it could do so much to help with this fear that many of us feel of the kind of creeping Islamism within the country. I don't know whether it's enough to have religious leaders or civil society leaders or business leaders come out and say, no, this is bad. I think we really need to have some kind of policy push here, or at least, you know, a legislative approach to say, This is not acceptable in Malaysia. This is not acceptable in a multicultural, multi-religious country.
Right. I mean, policy and legislation aside, though, given the reaction that we've seen to this ongoing saga here, you know, whether or not this should be a market-based decision, because looking at some of the commentary out there, if this is a private business and if this business sees, you know, fit or there's enough market demand to cater to Muslims only, and also given that or presumably, I don't know, down there in Muar Johor, you've got other laundromats, you know, in, well, within the same vicinity. I believe the owner of that Muslim-only laundromat had alluded to that, you know, that other non-Muslim customers can then visit those other laundromats. I wonder if that argument holds water, whether or not, you know, the markets, right, can actually dictate these kind of business behavior.
So you're saying that if they, you know, if non-Muslims... Non-Muslims don't have to go to that laundromat. They can go to any other laundromat. I still see a problem with that, with the idea that it's, you know, it's the business owner's prerogative to do it, because at the end of the day, it's discriminatory, and the Constitution says you cannot discriminate on based on faith. And lots of people come out and say, oh, what about kind of Chinese-speaking only, you know, job applicants or Chinese residents only? And that too, I think, is discriminatory. I'm not condoning that at all. In fact, Anne, I think I saw last night there was news that there was another Muslim-only laundromat that opened in Perlis.
Yeah. So from one end of the peninsula to the other.
Do you see where this is a slippery slope, right? So it starts with just one. And then someone else says, I'm going to do another one. And I'm going to do another one. And it mushrooms around. So I do think it's imperative that we address this now, because it tends to spread.
No, and now to be clear, you know, obviously my position is that yes, you know, given that we need to foster a more inclusive Malaysia, and certainly we are seeing that being evidenced at the public policy level, and so that's great, right? But you know, again, it is a discussion about how intrusive these legislations can be on private business decisions. And you raise an interesting analogy earlier about how some employers only employ Chinese-speaking only candidates, right? So we also ask Chi Wee, how far would the proposed laws extend? Like, would it stop a business from hiring Chinese speakers only?
The bill would make a distinction insofar as a requirement of a particular skill set. So, for instance, if you require an employee who speaks Mandarin in order to cater to a Mandarin-speaking clientele, then you can put up such a requirement. But in today's day and age, Mandarin is not the exclusive language of Chinese people. Many non-Chinese people can speak very good Mandarin, and better than me even. So I don't see a problem insofar as the law catering for that situation.
We also asked Chi Wee, you know, are laws the right approach to countering racism and racial discrimination?
I think laws are one of many tools to reduce racism and discrimination. The other more important tools are probably political leadership and education. What we need is it's really a government who has the political will and stamina to actually push through the measures to promote racial and religious harmony. So, for example, we have the situation of these three draft bills sitting in some drawer somewhere in Putrajaya, and no one's looking at it to consider, does it work? If it doesn't work, say so publicly. If you think it works, say so, and then commit to a timeline to push it through Parliament.
Again, that was Lim Chi Wee, the Deputy Chair of the Working Committee on Law and Policy of the NUCC. Now, we also reached out to Gerald Joseph, who is a commissioner with Suhakam. He echoed Chi Wee's stance that there needs to be more participation from the authorities and more political will.
The incidences of individuals or groups that decide on their own how Malaysia should be as either segmentation by race, religion, or ideologies of superiority does come up from time to time. And I think a government should actually say this is individual and is a no-go. You know, so the more people speak against it, I think then message gets across. I also believe that it's about time that we systematically take up the recommendations by the National Unity Consultative Council. So once the council was set up, you know, there's been a big gap for a few years. A report has not been made public. people are still waiting. There were some recommendations, and maybe it's about time. The more we wait, we are losing precious time in educating society on what's the way forward on this, the concept of a Bangsa Malaysia. So I really hope that will be the political will and fervor and flavor of all those at the top, including community leaders who must realize that Malaysia is actually a composition of many voices and minds, and everybody has a kind of an equal place, as the famous saying goes, under the Malaysian sun.
And that was Gerald Joseph, Commissioner with Sue Harkam. And I'll add to that in saying it's not just policy, political will, education, but I think it's important to highlight another tool that we can use in fostering this inclusive society is market decisions. In other words, you choose and or walk, either walk in or walk out with your wallets.
Like,
right?
like a boycott, like yeah, a consumer
yeah.
boycott.
Right. You know, so if you agree or disagree with these kind of policies, be it Muslim-only laundromats or otherwise, right, if markets then decide with their wallets and saying we are not going to patronize this business, then that would send the message out loud and clear.
Yeah, no, I definitely want to see these bills make an appearance, and I want to hear what the government's stand is on these bills. Have they been shelved in a drawer somewhere in Putrajaya that we don't know what's happened to them? And I think now more than ever, we need it. We need to have something like this strong and loud statement to say this is not acceptable behavior.
Bills, either legislative in nature or ringgit bills, you know, I think those will go a long ways. It's coming up to 7:18 right now on this Friday morning. Coming up, we'll be taking a look at the front pages on the local papers right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.